Welcome to Try Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glevsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. This is a storytelling podcast, so what you hear are great lawyers who are great people telling great stories from cases that had a profound impact on them. I'm still on a high from our last episode with Joe Freed, and my high continues with one of the best episodes today that we've ever done. I'm so grateful and glad to bring you today Nelson Tyrone. Nelson is from Atlanta and has been a phenomenal trial lawyer for the last couple of decades. He is truly a gem of a human being, one of the best listeners that I know, which is going to be evident in the story you're going to hear, and one of the best storytellers that I know. So let's get started. Please enjoy. Thanks. I'm very pleased and feel very lucky to have with us today Nelson Tyrone, who is a phenomenal human being, phenomenal trial lawyer, and a phenomenal teacher. Nelson is an amazing lawyer who practices in Atlanta, Georgia, although he tries cases all over the country, whose practice focuses on birth injury cases. Nelson, thanks for being with us.
Boy, I'm honored to be here, and I'm not sure I live up to that intro.
Nelson, can you share with us the story of a case that had a profound impact on you?
I can. You talked to me about this a few days ago, and I've really warmed up and been thinking about one of my former clients. I used to be a criminal defense lawyer, and so this is a client of mine. It was one of the last criminal defense cases that I handled, and his name is Hua Ta. H-O-A is his first name, pronounced Hua. T-A is his last name. And I think it was maybe 7-8 years ago, but it really has had a lasting impact on me. So should I just tell you a little bit about him?
Please.
Hua, I was a criminal defense lawyer in Atlanta. Hua was indicted in federal court. He's a 19-year-old kid from a Vietnamese family who lived in Portland, Oregon. And Hua was charged with some horrible stuff. Drug conspiracy, kidnapping. And the kidnapping was alleged to have involved Atlanta, Georgia. And that's why the case was in Atlanta. And when Hua was charged, initially there were 5 co-defendants who were alleged to be his Vietnamese gang co-conspirators. By the time we were heading towards trial, those other co-conspirators had all pled guilty and would be testifying against Hua at trial. And Hua, from the very start, had explained to me that he was innocent. And the story that he told me from the very start, he was innocent. It was just a very complicated set of circumstances, and he just got caught up in. So let me tell you a little bit about Hua. Was charged with being involved in a drug conspiracy and a drug deal gone wrong. And the allegation was that when the drug deal went wrong, meaning when the allegation was that Hua and his part of the drug conspiracy did not show up at the drug deal with the money. They were allowed to take the drugs from the deal and never returned. And then the allegation was that in order to even up that debt, for Hua to be held responsible by the drug gang for the money being lost, that Hua had to be part of a kidnapping. And the allegation was that Hua conspired and helped the drug dealing gang kidnap a person in Atlanta, Georgia, to then take them back to Portland, hold them for ransom. That was the story that the government told. And it was a pretty compelling story. And the reason that it was so compelling is that if we go backwards from the moment the police showed up on the scene When the FBI showed up to free the kidnapped victim at the end of the story, they showed up at a hotel room in Portland, Oregon, and there were two people in the hotel room. One was Hua, and one was an elderly gentleman who was the kidnapped victim. And the kidnapped victim was very clear that he had not been allowed to leave, that he was not allowed to leave the hotel room. He was being held, and that Hua was the member of the team holding him who'd been left behind to keep him from leaving. And so it sure looked like a kidnapping. I mean, there was one person who had nothing to do with the crime and was a kidnapped victim. And then there was Hua, who clearly had had something to do with the crime. So that's where we started. And all the co-conspirators basically said, yeah, we were part of this gang. We were trying to do a drug deal. Hua was in on it. Hua was supposed to arrange for someone to show up with some money. Hua and that person did not show up. And then we told Hua the only way to help us is to kidnap a family member of that person, and we'll hold them for ransom and get our money back.
That sounds like the odds were stacked against you from the get-go. I mean, four or five witnesses were all going to testify against Hua. How'd that feel?
It wasn't the people stacked up against us that I was so concerned about. It just sounded like an impossible story, to be honest with you. Yes, so very much so, I felt that the odds were stacked against us. Just in trying to tell you the story, I did a very average job. It's a very complicated story, and it's several stories at once. There's this. I mean, Hua had a relationship with a girl who was involved in a drug deal. And his relationship with the girl was that he didn't really have a relationship, he just wanted to. Hua was kind of a nerdy kid. He's a Vietnamese kid hanging out in Portland. And all the Vietnamese kids would hang out at coffee shops and try to act cool. And there was a group of guys from his high school who were the cool guys. They were tough. And they looked like a gang to Hua. But they had girls around them. They had cool cars. And Hua he wasn't friends with them, but they were the cool guys. And Hua had a romantic interest who was one of those guys' girlfriends. Hua just thought this pretty Vietnamese girl, if he could ever get her to talk to him, wouldn't that be cool? And he never could. She didn't know he existed. And so he would just, you know, it's like all of us. There's that girl that you know is never going to notice you and never going to know your name, but you admire her from a distance. Well, she was kind of rough around the edges too. And that group of Vietnamese guys, and they did drugs and did small drug deals and sort of fancied themselves tough guys and were probably headed to being real tough guys as they grew up. So that girl came to Hua and started to pay him a little of attention. And I think that she was probably just taking advantage of him. And she came to him with the story, gosh, we're trying to do a drug deal and it's really important. I need the money. And do you think you could help us find somebody? And Hua said, well, this group of guys, I think they're drug dealers. And she didn't know all of the guys in the group. And Hua said, well, maybe I could go to them. Maybe they could help you. And so Hua introduced himself to the tough guys and said, hey, I have a friend. She wants to be involved in a drug deal. Could you help her out? Not smart things to do. Really foolish, bad decision-making by Hua. I think he was just naive to really appreciate what he was getting involved in. The bad guy said, sure, we'll do a drug deal. We want you and the girl to show up. And we'll bring the drugs, have the girl bring the money, and it's on. So they set up a time to meet. Hua was supposed to show up, and he got cold feet and couldn't do it. And so the girl and her cohort showed up at the drug deal. They were allowed to leave with the drugs on a promise of returning with the money, and they never returned. So, A, not very smart drug dealers. to let the drugs leave without money, something you'd see in a movie, not very sophisticated guys. And B, they're now holding Hua responsible. They figure he was part of the setup. And so the very next day, when Hua's mom looks out the door, the window of their house, Hua lives at home with his brother and sister and parents. Mom sees five tough-looking Vietnamese kids surrounding her son, and she knows there's trouble. She'd never seen it before. She'd never seen her son in trouble before. These weren't kids that they knew or that he knew or had ever hung out with, and she knew there was trouble. Mom comes out, shoos the boys away, tells them she'll call the police, brings Hua inside, and after a lot of denials by Hua and a lot of refusals to say what's going on, there's a family meeting. And the family sits down and says, what's going on? And he tells them the story I just told you. Here's what happened, and I don't know what to do about it. And they're telling me that she owes them $10,000, and if I don't come up with $10,000, they're gonna kill me. The family decides, well, we've gotta come up with some money. They have maybe $1,000, $1,200 in savings. They give it to Hua. He takes it to the tough guys. It's not enough. They beat him up and send him home and say, get more. And so over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks, there are phone calls to Hua saying, where are you? Where's the money? Hua would go to meet the tough guys at the coffee shop. They would beat him up and threaten him and say, we need the money or we're going to kill you, kill your family. Hua would go back to his family. They would try to come up with money and they would send what they could. And at the end of that process, they were $6,000-$7,000 short. They'd come up with everything they had. Sold a car. They didn't have more money. And that's when the kidnapping idea came up. The tough guy said, well, then we're going to go kidnap that girl, and we're going to hold her for ransom until whoever she's teaming up with pays the money. They figured out that she lived in Atlanta or was in Atlanta, had family in Atlanta. And so they told Hua, you got to come with us, show us where her family lives in Atlanta, tell us what you know, be a part of it, or we're going to kill your family. And so there was a scene where the family says goodbye to him, and he hops in the car with one of the tough guys and they wave goodbye, and they really don't know if they'll ever see him again. Hua and the tough guys drive to Atlanta. They pull up outside where they think the girl is. There's a car pulling up that matches her car, a black Civic. Someone steps out of the car. The tough guys run out and grab them. It's not the girl. It's an elderly man. It's her father. And they just grab him and stuff him in the car and drive away. Drive all the way back to Portland, find a hotel outside of town, and hole up and figure, we're going to get our money. We now have someone connected to the person who ripped us off. And so the tough guys leave Hua in the hotel room and they go out to celebrate because they figure they're about to get paid. They call their girlfriends up, they go out drinking, and Hua and the old man are left in the hotel room. The FBI intercepts a call. Within a day or so, the FBI shows up at the hotel and Hua and the old man are there. And so how do you tell that story? Why doesn't Hua leave the hotel room? Why hasn't the family, his family, called the police? There are all these disconnects. If he's really an innocent man, why doesn't he do something about it? Why doesn't he run for help? And why doesn't his family call for help? And that, to me, was the biggest challenge. I believed he was an innocent man, but boy, it sure didn't look like it. And it didn't fit what I would have done or my family would have done if I was in trouble. So there we were, trying to figure it out. And I picked this client and case because I was deeply involved in psychodrama at that point. I mean, still am, but I feel like maybe even more then. and we, but I didn't have the resources to hire a psychodramatist the way I do now. I didn't have any resources. I was appointed to handle the case, a federal appointed case. And so, and Hua was held without bond. And so I did a couple of things that I thought were really, that really honored this method. And I wanted to share those. One, we did reenactments in his jail cell with lots of plastic chairs. And so there was a meeting room at the federal pretrial where I was allowed to meet with him, not through the glass, but person to person. But it was just the two of us, and I had an interpreter to help with Vietnamese.
And can you share with us what a reenactment is?
So our goal was to try to put into action these scenes that Hua was telling me are part of his story, so that I could, one, experience them myself, and two, look around the scene and see if I picked up on anything that helped make sense of our story. Not just rely on what he was telling me, but actually go live the scene to see if there was something there that helped make sense of why he didn't call the police, why his family didn't call the police, something. And I guess three, if I was going to choose any of these scenes to help advance her case, I needed to have lived them myself. And so we would, if Hua wanted to, well, when Hua told me the story about the five tough guys in his front yard, we made the meeting room into his front yard. I had Hua stand in the middle of the room, and we stacked chairs around, and I had him become each one of the five tough guys by sitting in the chair, telling what he knows about the tough guy, inhabiting the role of the tough guy, and then stepping out back into his role and into another chair. So we had, I could see with my own eyes, and Hua could experience in real time that moment of being surrounded by, although not tough guys, chairs, and trying to relive the experience of what it felt like. And then, of course, his mother is seeing that, and so we'd have a chair be his mother. And I used our interpreter as what's called an auxiliary. So the interpreter, if it was important for the mother to say something to Hua, I'd have the interpreter be the mother. Hua would tell us what mom said. Oh, mom came out and told the tough guys, I'm going to call the cops. The interpreter would repeat those words so that Hua could hear it and experience that moment again. So we did a lot of that. And we discovered several things. We discovered that at one point, when the tough guys were claiming, we discovered at one point that the tough guys, when they were back in Portland, went to the police station to pay some traffic tickets because they were afraid that their getaway car might get towed if they parked it somewhere because they had outstanding traffic tickets. And when they did that, they left the old man, the kidnapped victim, in the car by himself. But the tough guys didn't leave Hua because they wanted to keep an eye on him, so they took him with them into the police station. So there was a scene where we didn't discover this until a few days before trial started. I mean, we worked through 20, 30 scenes, and then one day Hua just decided to share with me that, gosh, they left the kidnapped victim in a car by himself outside a police station, and he didn't run. And that helped us begin to understand that the kidnapped victim was not going to run any more than Hua was going to run, because that would just turn the bad guys on their family. And that would be a cowardly thing to do. They would save their own skin, but they would just redirect whatever consequence there was going to be back towards people they loved. And for the kidnapped victim, it was his daughter who'd gotten caught up with these drug dealers. And for Hua, it was his family. And so they were both kidnapped victims. And that's what we ultimately discovered. And that's the story that we told the jury, which was a true story. So that was an important part of the method. The other thing that I wanted to share was that his culture seemed so foreign to me. And he kept explaining to me that Vietnamese people don't call the police. Not his community. They didn't trust the police. the police they felt were racist. And so they would only go to the police as a last, in an emergency, and they really wouldn't even go. They would try to solve it themselves. And I was trying to unpack and understand why they had never called the police. If you're the family member, your son is in this position of being in great danger, you're being threatened for money and extorted, why don't you involve law enforcement? And so I went and lived with the family and slept on the floor in their home and took my shoes and socks off to walk in their house and sat among the bamboo plants and ate Vietnamese food and sat while they prayed. They were Buddhists. And really just tried to soak in how foreign it was and how they were living in Vietnam in a little suburb in Portland. And it's the moment you walked through their door, it was Vietnam. Every plant, everything they ate, every word out of their mouth, their culture, their customs, everything was Vietnamese. And it helped me understand and believe why they would continue to act that way and not call the police.
Can you share with us a bit about how you told this story, whether it was in first person or something about how you told it?
So here's the most important thing I want to share with you. I was thinking about this. So of all the things that I would share, here's what I choose. It was a very complicated story of this wanting to like the girl and these drug dealers and this drug deal that goes bad and this kidnapping in another state. And it just was too much. It was hard to explain. And so I was desperate for a way to simplify it. I found that every time I tried to tell it, like today, it just would take 20 minutes. And I was looking for something that was simpler and more powerful and easier to communicate. Because it sounded like I was making excuses by taking so long to explain it. We had a Vietnamese interpreter during the trial. The trial lasted several weeks. I was searching for a way to simplify my message to the jury about this young man who got caught up in something beyond his control. He was way out of his element, way over his head, and he couldn't stop it. That's what I believe the story was. And as I kept telling that story to everyone who would listen, I ended up telling it to the interpreter. She and I would, on coffee breaks, we would talk. And I was telling her that story. I could tell that she had feelings, warm feelings for my client and was sympathetic. And she said to me, that reminds me of a story in my culture. And it's the story of the boy on the back of the running tiger. And so here it is. There are two boys walking through the jungle. And one of them was a very mischievous boy who knew a lot about the world. And the other boy was naive and not popular and not mischievous. But he felt good hanging out with someone who was popular. And as they walked through the jungle, they came upon a sleeping tiger. Now, the naive boy didn't know anything about tigers, never seen one, didn't know anything about them. But the mischievous boy did. He had traveled a lot more and knew a lot about the world, and he decided to play a trick on his friend. And so the mischievous boy said to his naive companion, "You know, I'm so tired of walking. I bet you are too. You know, I bet that tiger would be willing to give you a ride on his back if you just climbed on." And the naive boy said, "I am tired, but I don't know that he'll let me, and I'm a little scared." And the mischievous boy said, "No, don't be scared. Tigers love it when little boys crawl on top of them. You'll see." And so the naive boy, trusting his friend and not knowing better, climbed on the back of the sleeping tiger. The tiger immediately awoke, arched his back, and took off running at full speed through the jungle. And so there you have it. You have a boy on the back of a running tiger. Now, what are his choices? If he lets go, he's thrown off and surely eaten. If he doesn't let go and he holds on, he is forever on the back of running tiger. And the light just went off for me when she told me that story. And so, in closing argument, after we had done our work in the trial, my wife had found an image, a black and white image of a tiger sprinting. And she, as an architect, they're good artists as well. And she drew in an image, just a silhouette of a boy holding on to the back of the tiger. So all you could see was black and white, but you could tell that there was a tiger running and there was a little image of a boy holding on. And I started my closing with that image on a screen, and I didn't say a word. I just clicked on the projector, the image came up on the screen, and I stood there with the jury. It felt like forever. It was probably more like 5 minutes as we all just looked at the image. And then I said, you know, I've told a lot of friends about the story of this case because it's been hard for me to understand. And I've been trying to figure out a way to tell it in a simple way that was honest and made sense. And one of my friends is Vietnamese. And she said, that reminds me of a story. And so let me tell you the story of the boy on the back of the running tiger. And so I told the story, just like I did now. And I saw, maybe for the only time in my life as a lawyer, every juror nodding their head at the same time. And after a very short deliberation, they found Hua not guilty on all charges. Had they convicted him on any of the charges, he would have been in prison for 20 years. And they came out and asked the judge if they could speak with him, and came over and embraced him and told him that he needed to get his act together and that he'd been given a second chance and to make better choices about who he spent time with. And Hua was released that day. He had no place to stay, so he came home with me and spent the night in my loft. And he just always has had a warm place in my heart. And I continue almost every year to get a Christmas card from his family.
What an amazing story.
It's one of my finest and most favorite moments as a lawyer ever.
Share with us how that impacted you.
I really came to believe that a lawyer can overcome a much bigger, more powerful opponent, like the United States government. I came to believe powerfully in the power of story and metaphor. That there are human truths that we all understand and appreciate. And if you can just find the one that communicates your client's story that the jury already knows to be true, whether they've heard the story or not, they know the message to be true, that can lead to justice. It can lead a jury of 12 people to walk a young man charged with horrible crimes out of a jury, out of a courtroom, and free him, despite all of the allegations against him and all of the co-defendants who testified that he was part of their gang. And so I'm constantly searching for the metaphor. So I guess that's, of all that rambling, probably the most important thing that it has left with me is that image on the screen, and I have it to this day, of the boy on the back of the tiger, and how hard work, some luck, if you can find the story, it has incredible power.
Nelson, what advice do you have for young lawyers out there?
Outwork your opponent. You almost always can. In the kind of work we do, whether it's criminal defense or if you represent people who are hurt or people who've been defrauded, we have the ability to get to know our clients and their stories better than our opponents do. So do that. Dig in, expend yourself, learning everything you can and soaking it in. And then be open to finding a way to communicate that simply with a story, a metaphor. Because there are only a handful of stories in the world. We've all been betrayed. We've all felt less than. We've all gotten over our heads. And we've all gotten in situations, I mean, I know I have, where it felt like I had started out or caused something to be started that I couldn't stop. And I felt powerless to do anything to stop it. And I felt that I'm just watching what I know is going to be a bad or painful result occur because of some action I took. And I believe that those jurors had experienced that as well. And if you live long enough and you're honest about it, you've experienced all these stories. We've all felt less than. We've all felt betrayed. We've all felt not good enough. We've all felt, boy, I've done this thing and I can't stop the results. And if you can be honest about that and find that story and communicate it to other human beings, then they can embrace it.
And lastly, Nelson, I know you are a tremendous, tremendous listener. I've seen you talk about your cases with anyone who will listen, and you listening to them and thinking about it and taking notes. And you've shared with us how you got the trial theme for your closing argument from the interpreter who happened to be working on the case. Can you talk a little bit about listening?
Boy, I'm a good talker. I don't know if that's what got me to be a lawyer or led me to be a lawyer. And then lawyering and law school teaches you to talk all the time. And so it's really, I had to be redirected to spend more time listening. And now on my good days, I spend more time listening and taking in what's around me than talking and sharing my own point of view. And so in this example with Hua, I never would have gotten to the point of understanding that the kidnapped victim had been left outside by himself 100 feet from police officers, or 20 feet as they walked by the car. And I never would have gotten to understanding that I could really show the jury that Hua was a kidnapped victim, just like the kidnapped victim in the indictment. So I spent a lot of time listening to him, and then so grateful that I listened to my interpreter and shared the story with her, because that story didn't come from me, it came from her. And here at the college, I'm surrounded by incredibly talented lawyers and human beings. And so I really stretch my ears out and try to take in.
Yeah, and the college is, of course, Trial Lawyers College. And I actually am going to ask you one more question, because I think a lot of us have a lot to learn from you about balance and self-care. What do you do to deal with the stress of being a trial lawyer?
Well, there's a lot of stress to being a trial lawyer. There's a lot on the line. And I feel it with my clients. I feel it financially. I feel an obligation to my family. I feel all those things. There's never enough time, never enough days. For me, among the things I do, you know, I'm sober now. It'll be 14 years this July.
Congratulations.
Well, God bless. I can't take responsibility for it, but it's a beautiful thing. So I am in essentially group therapy several times a week, going to AA meetings, not because I think about drinking anymore, I don't, but because I have stresses of life that I didn't used to deal with very well, and I would stuff them and I would drink to deal with them, and I don't want to do that anymore. So I spend a lot of time talking about what's going on with me, trying to be honest about it and let people know how I'm doing, really doing. And taking feedback from people. I meditate. I carve out time in the morning where it's just me. And I can either read something from the big book, AA-related, or read self-help work. I'm reading Brené Brown right now and meditate on that. What else do?
I know you're pretty athletic.
Yeah, for me, running and sports help take some of the crazy away, and they're meditative for me. Running can be very meditative for me. I try to pay more attention to sleep these days. I used to run myself really ragged, and so I try to pay more attention to that. I'd say more than anything, I just daily remind myself, and some days I do a good job and some days I don't, but daily I'm trying to remind myself to honestly check in with how I'm doing and to communicate that to somebody. And if I'm not doing well, even if it's embarrassing, I try to let somebody know I'm not doing so hot. It takes the pressure off of trying to keep that mask where everything's perfect and I'm confident and everything's awesome and I have no problems. It's a lot of work to keep that facade up, and so I try not to have that facade up.
Well, Nelson, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, I've learned a lot sitting in this room talking with you, and I've learned a lot from you over the years. And I'm very appreciative on behalf of your clients, on behalf of the lawyers you've taught around the country for the last almost couple decades, and just feel very lucky to have you as someone in my life. Thank you very much for all your gifts.
I love being here, and I love spending time with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.